Succession number 28495, rule number 13.
Oh, who's reel 13?
Right, we're now about to leave Sydney and we're going to fly north. So it's on the 21st of July 1945. Dakota, he flew us north from Muscat Airport to Brisbane and then on to Orchardfield and Townsville. The flight north was a wonderful experience because we were flying over the Great Barrier Reef. The sun was setting over to the left port, a beautiful, bright golden glow, and the full moon was rising to starboard over the Pacific, creating just a highway of silver across the ocean. It's the most fantastic sight, and I did my best to stay awake as long as I could to watch it. This Dakota was a cargo plane. There were practically no seats that we could find. We were probably sitting on sacks of mail or whatever we could find, and just our small party of pilots and just one or two others. So we continued in this style until we flew across New Guinea, and we landed at an American airfield base there for an excellent breakfast, really super breakfast. And then they flew us on to Manus in the Admiralty Islands, which was the headquarters of the British Pacific Fleet. And we are now in holiday mood. We're thinking of sunbathing on beaches. And as soon as we got to Manus, they flew us over to a little tiny coral island, and they'd given it the name HMS Nabran. This tiny coral island, they'd evacuated all the residents, and it now consisted of 9/10 airstrip, metal airstrip, and a tiny area of for maintenance buildings and mess and so on. And the highest point on the land was probably about 20 feet or less. And on one side, you could wade out half a mile in shallow water, poking giant clams. Fascinating business. And on the other side, in sort of 20-foot depth of water, a little jetty carried the saltwater showers and the wash basins. And you never took valuables there, because if you dropped in the sea, nobody's going to dive down through a big shoal of barracuda, which were always there. Interesting place. We had to do 6 idles. I did 6, and the batsman took me to one side afterwards, and he'd already seen our logbooks, so he knew what we'd been doing before. And he said to me, "I am not satisfied with those landing shoes. You're going to have to do another 6. And he said, "I can keep you here until I'm satisfied." A passport for survival, which nobody would have thought of, of course. So I was the only one to get this threat. So the next day, I spent all day watching the others doing adults. One Corsair, one Seafire. We had a little building, like a cricket pavilion, watching the game. The Seafire had made its last landing, and it was running fairly slowly up the strip and swung off to one side onto soft, sandy material, and ever so slowly tipped forward onto its nose and rolled onto its back. And we said some rather rude things about the pilot, and 10 minutes later we were told he was dead. Coming towards the end of that day, it was now my turn. The Corsair now had a fixed undercarriage. It couldn't retract its undercarriage. But the thermals had gone. It was cool and there was no buffeting. It was ideal conditions. An interesting feature that when you took off from the runway and made the first turn to port, you crossed a little bay, and down in something like 30 foot of water, an American single-engine aircraft sat there, a recent crash, and did not yet come to get the pilot out. And you saw this every time you made the turn. I decided I had nothing to lose. So I went round and I made the best landing I could in the centre of the runway, right opposite the batsman. And then each time I went round, I moved the aircraft over a little bit. And on the last three landings, I put the wing over the batsman's head, deliberately. It was a bit of bullfight. You just like the bullfight, the toreador and the bull and the cloak. Having completed the landing and parked the aircraft, I was walking up the runway with the parachute, feeling comfortable. I'd enjoyed myself. And the batsman's jeep pulled up alongside me and said, "Do you want a lift?" And I was enjoying the walk, but I couldn't refuse the lift to the offer. So I climbed on board. I let the silence settle on us. And then after a short time, the batsman said, "Those landings, did you mean to do them like that?" So I looked at him and said, "Well, what do you think?" End of conversation. Now, there's one thing about having a bar in the Navy, you can settle differences of opinion. So that evening after dinner, we shared drinks. And he looked at me and he said, "Hughes, I think I'd better let you go, haven't I?" I said, "Yes, please." So I went. That was a valuable lesson. I really needed that lesson. And I'd forgotten, of course, that he'd been at the end of the runway all day, working hard. You don't think of this, do you? My next landing was on the Formidable. We were put on... Did I drop something? We were put on a small escort carrier. I think it was the Arbiter, which is carrying us as passengers and a few corsairs, and steamed up north to join the Formidable. And we did practice accelerated takeoff in case we were required to fly the aircraft off. When we got to Formidable, they very sensibly said, "We want our own men to do it." So they came over to fly the aircraft off, and we crossed by Breeches Boy. It's a new experience, quite interesting.
How does that work then? How does that work?
A Breeches Boy, well, there's a carrier wire between the two ships, and a pulley, or the runner, and so a rope to each end. Once you get into the Breeches Boy system and you're hanging on this rope and this pulley, the far end snatches you across and you get on board, and then they pull it back for the next man. But in my book, there's a record of where the ships parted and broke the wire, and the fellas had to learn to swim. So we got on board dry. We immediately were interviewed by the captain and the squadron leaders, and my squadron, 1841, they wanted one pilot, and 1842 wanted seven. So I was already, if you like, on my own, having lost my best friend, and the others were in groups. So I was quite happy to go into 1841. They all went into 1842. Not one of them flew operations. They'd taken their harp to the party and nobody asked them to play. And so about the second day, I was scheduled to fly.
Is this the operation that you flew when Robert Gray won the VC?
Yes, that's right.
Can you take me step by step through that day, as much detail as you can remember?
Yes.
From briefing to the end and conclusion of that, and the type of raid it was going to be.
Well, the briefing was, it seemed to me, fairly informal, in that they already knew the geography and the pattern. The fleet was working its way slowly up the coast, and aircraft on the ground were always a high priority because of kamikaze, but shipping warships was a higher priority. Effectively, the fleet were working up the coast, delousing the coast as they went. So each time you moved up, you find new harbours and new shipping. So we were briefed to attack an airfield which had been attacked regularly, had been attacked early that morning, but on the last minute before takeoff, our leader, Gray, was given a verbal message warships in this bay on Ogawa higher priority. So it was a routine flight out, 10,000 feet, 8 aircraft in 2 units of sort of 4 and 4. We looked at the airfield and he decided that it had already been attacked early that way, that day anyway. And we'd seen the shipping in the bay, so we decided to go for the shipping. Meanwhile, at 10,000 feet, we were experiencing anti-aircraft fire. We could see the smoke and we could feel the vibration. And what interested me, you could smell it. We weren't using oxygen, but you could still smell it, which I'm a bit surprised at that. So the leader decided to go for this destroyer. Well, from the 10th, there was the sea and the hills. We were flying over hills, and then we had to fly more or less down the contour of the hills and then level out to what would be effectively a fairly low-level slight diving attack, not a steep dive at all. All 8 aircraft going down this one direction. And the order of flight obviously must have got disturbed, as I discovered later on from reading. And when I went over the aircraft, firing on the ship and then lifted to go over it, there was only one plane in front of me, couldn't see any others. And suddenly his wing, one wing exploded at about 50 feet and he went and hit the sea instantly, that was it. We formed up. The man who I was, my number one, became now the leader for the rest of us. We formed up and we went back and made more attacks, and according to the according to that book, Formidable Hero, when I read later, that said we sank 2 destroyers and put a bomb into a third. I know we attacked 3 ships. Having reorganised, we're flying back, and I counted 5 aircraft, should have been 7. I didn't know what had happened to the other 2 until later, but I immediately found that I was flying too fast. I couldn't throttle back. The throttle was jammed. So I told them, so they had to speed up a little bit to keep with me. We never flew straight to the fleet because of the kamikaze problem. You always flew to a little picket fleet, a cruiser and 2 or 3 destroyers. You go to them and fly around them safely so they could identify you. You'd already given a warning anyway. They knew you were coming. But they were also delousing to make sure you're not picked up a Japanese kamikaze coming with you. It did happen. Once they'd cleared you, they would send you up to the main fleet, up a corridor, safe corridor. That was the only route to safely approach the fleet. And as soon as we got near the fleet, you break off to pick up your own aircraft carrier. The battleship King George V, the flagship, was in the centre, and then there'd be a sort of diamond pattern of 4 carriers, and quite some distance between them. Well, as soon as we went into the circuit and putting the undercarriage down, I realised I couldn't because I had no hydraulic power. So I left the circuit and started going around King George V, pumping the undercarriage down, dropped the seat to make it comfortable and started pumping away. And so my flying was a bit ragged, but it didn't matter. And I thought, I wonder how many guns are following me, because it wasn't uncommon. A number of planes had shot down by friendly fire. So I got the wheels down and locked. So I then rejoined the circuit and I pumped the flaps down. Now, I'd reported all this to the carrier, obviously. The carrier now was forward of the barrier, was crowded with aircraft, those that had just landed and those bombed, ready to go. I wasn't given permission to land, and I wasn't refused permission to land. I had no response. So I thought, okay, went into land. And the flaps don't lock down. I had to keep pumping them down, as I discovered, because on the last approach, I could see these flaps creeping up. And I'd worked it out in advance. If I try to open this throttle, it might open, it might not. And if it does open, it might ratchet and not come back. So I thought, I may not have power to take a wave off. You know, I was chancing my arm, but I thought, well, it's a choice of bailing out or ditching, and this is a good aeroplane. I didn't want to waste it. That was my main thought. And I told them that I'd have to switch the engine off. So I went in, hit the deck, felt the arrestor wire, enormous relief, switched the engine off, switched myself off, thumping on the cockpit, pointed out that the engine hadn't stopped. It was still running at something like 60% of full power. So it was still pulling on the wire. They couldn't unhook it anyway. And if they had, I'd have gone straight into the barrier. So it took me a little while to work out how to stop an engine. In that we'd not been trained to switch the petrol off. Never happened before. So I switched the petrol off. Now I'd finished. And then I staggered out. Now, in the films, they run to man the aircraft, don't they? We were sitting on a parachute, a dinghy, and a flat water bottle holding about a gallon of water. We wore a lifeman's, a seaman's safety life belt filled with the water, that would hold about a gallon, and tucked into our flying suit were as many cans of water as we could get in. You had to be helped in and out. And once I'd been helped out and I was tottering, this was a 3-hour flight, you know, longest we'd ever done. And I tottered into the crew room and started dropping all this gear, and the tannhouse said, "Hughes, report to the bridge." I thought, I'm in for it this time. I went up to the first level, which is the air bridge, not us. Went up to the captain's bridge, not us. I went up to the Admiral, Admiral Vian, or Vian, who was the Admiral of the carriers. And I stood in the just inside the door of the bridge in a scruffy blue workman's boiler suit. They were short of flying suits, so I had to make do with a boiler suit. I couldn't imagine how scruffy I was. And everything was gleaming, and a midshipman lifted a flap and snapped at the engine room to tell them to stop making black smoke. And then a few minutes later he did it again and tell them to stop making white smoke. Oh, good Lord, what's going to happen to me? And there was an enormous thump on the back of the shoulders. I don't know why I didn't fall over. I tottered a few steps, turned around, and there's the Admiral grinning all over his face. It was his way of saying, OK, good show, or whatever. I can't think what was said. I don't suppose I was capable of saying anything. But that was sufficient, and he let me go. And by the time I got down to debriefing, they'd pretty well finished debriefing. I was at least half an hour or more behind them. And I realised where we carried all this water, because entering the debriefing, there's a table full of drinks. And I got a hold of a glass of orange juice and it disappeared, and the second one disappeared, and I picked up two more to take in with me, and we were debriefed. As the new boy, I could not say, why on earth did we all 8 fly in a straight line on the target, sitting target? I couldn't say it, but that's what I was thinking. And I was also thinking, ricochets. Who shot Grey down? The Japs, or us, or me? Because we had seen all these ricochets in training. Obviously, I couldn't see anything like this. The other two who had left early, one had had his undercarriage damaged and dropped, so he had to fly back and somebody escorted him back. The interesting thing is that later on I discovered that the leaders, I hadn't been told, or I don't remember, the leaders had been told the war's nearly over, take it easy. And this was the day they dropped the second atom bomb. And perhaps the worst thing of all was that in the afternoon, one of our squadron pilots, making a priority landing because of a fuel leak, he ran out of fuel a few feet from the deck. And instead of landing on the deck, and 3 or 4 seconds of petrol would have done it, he hit the back and probably concussed. The aircraft broke and it fell into the sea and he didn't get out. He was a Canadian, and the Grey, who was shot down in the morning, was a Canadian. And both of those were probably on their last official flights. The Canadian government had given the date indicating that their pilots with experience, they felt they'd done enough, and they felt it was time to give them a rest, the way the Air Force did tours of duty.
Could I ask a little bit about the action? What had Robert Gray done that the other aircraft hadn't had done in that action? Was there anything that you noticed, that it was specifically different in his form of attack than yours?
Well, I'd not done any other operations, of course, but he had a reputation because he'd been attacking the Tirpitz, and he'd already won the DFC and he was due for another one. He had this very characteristic, you know, determined, go straight into it. Well, that's all you can do in that situation. Now, it is not generally well known, but in combat flying, skill counts. In dogfighting, skill counts. And the squadron losses in combat flying are a certain level. But as soon as that same squadron goes down to do ground attack on well-defended targets, the loss rate goes up by a factor of 3. And it's the leaders who suffer, because now skill isn't counting. If you're flying straight at guns, it doesn't matter what you can do, you're a sitting target. And this has been found by a number of ones. See that book there, the P-51. As soon as the P-51, which is the...
The Mustang.
The Mustang. As soon as the Mustang got her superiority over Germany, up to that time, they had a certain level of losses, but then they were allowed to carry bombs and do low-level attacks. As soon as they went down to do low-level attacks, the combat level of losses tripled when they did low-level.
So, with Gray, how did he get to be awarded the Victoria Cross for that? Because obviously who'd witnessed the action that he was involved in?
Well, there was a good deal of deliberation over this. And the decision was made by the admiral, the captain, and the leader of the squadron. They had a long meeting over a lot of discussion, and he might have had the DFC for that, or DSO otherwise, but after much deliberation they felt that it was right to an award of a Victoria Cross for this special circumstances, and possibly because only one other Victoria Cross had been awarded to the Fleet Air Arm, and that was to the man who made a suicide attack, Esmond, on the Scharnhorst and Neisenauer in their dash through the tunnel flying 6 swordfish, and they were all shot down. He was flying from land. Gray is the only man to have won the Victoria Cross in the Fleet Air Arm flying off a carrier. So that's a unique thing too. So it was generally agreed that that was the appropriate award. I think most people thought that was right.
Given it was your first experience of combat, what was the kind of conditions like as you headed into to the attack? Was there a lot of anti-aircraft fire? Was it a quick experience?
It was difficult to judge. There was certainly plenty of aircraft fire. It's possible that my damage was done by the high-level aircraft. So when I went into the dive, it's possible that I was at a higher power than the others. I still think I was just behind the leader when I should have been at about number 4 or 5. Certainly, the other wingman in our unit was ahead of his unit. You know, we were all going down at different speeds. I wouldn't call the anti-aircraft fire very, very heavy, but the fire from the ships must have been pretty heavy because there was more than one ship. But you're not conscious of this, and you can't feel it. It's not exploding like the big shells. It's invisible in daylight, and you don't hear it if it goes past you. So I can only say that. I mean, certainly reading up afterwards and listening to the reports, I realised how inexperienced I was at that time.
But were you able to drop your bombs on the target?
Yeah. Mm. I think so because of the, because of the training we'd had previously. After I'd landed my aircraft, I now knew the ignition wasn't working. The next day I went down to see the engineers to find out what the problem was, and they burst out laughing and said, "Oh, that thing, it's a non-flyable dud." I said, "Oh, okay, so what else, don't I know?" And they said, "Well, the shrapnel that caused the damage that you're aware of, it went into the supercharger and rattled around the supercharger. You could not have taken off." He said, "As a matter of fact, you could not have taken a wave off." I didn't know that, fortunately. You see, the right decision there would have been to order me to bail out a ditch, because I was not only putting myself at risk, but putting the whole ship and a lot of people at risk. Because the few incidents which have occurred where a plane has crashed through the barrier into the parking, thus being the shambles, you know, you set off a lot of trouble for yourself there.
But did you fly the next day? I believe the one last tour before the end of the war?
I did fly the following day, but this was combat air patrol.
So how are they arranged?
It was a normal takeoff. And the problem here is you may sit on the deck as in a standby situation. At any given time, each carrier has got at least two of its aircraft patrolling. No, four. There'll be two at 30,000, two at 15,000, and then you switch places. And this is the three-hour flight. But then they'll have others on the deck at standby to take off. Now, you could be at standby for an hour and then be launched and maybe have to do another hour's flying. It's too bad if you want to go to the toilet. or if you're sitting on the deck and the fumes from the engine room are sweeping over you and you're suffocating in these fumes from the boilers, it's most uncomfortable. And you don't risk too much oxygen in case you need it at 30,000 feet.
Was it an eventful combat patrol, or was it...
It was completely uneventful. There were very few suicide planes then. We pretty well got on top of them, and very often they were intercepted at some distance. But there's no doubt about it that a critical feature of those operations was the control. They had... In the control room, the radar radio control room, there's an enormous glass disc. And on the back side, the seamen trained in this were writing the information, the way you've seen it on television, on films, on a board, REF, manoeuvring on the chart down below. Well, on the ship, they can't do that, so they put it vertically. And so they write on with China graph. And the people doing the controllers are reading this information from this, and of course the ship is always the centre of this disc, which helps the control to some extent.